Nothing more was said about the big dog for over a week. But Siegfried's professional conscience must have been niggling at him, because he came into the dispensary one afternoon when Tristan and I were busy at the tasks which have passed into history, making up fever drinks, stomach powders, boric acid pessaries. He was elaborately casual. "Oh, by the way, I dropped a note to Joe Mulligan. I'm not entirely convinced that we have adequately explored the causes of his dog's symptoms. This vomiting is almost certainly due to depraved appetite, but I just want to make sure. So I've asked him to bring him round tomorrow afternoon between 2 and 2:30, when we'll all be here." No cries of joy greeted his statement, so he continued. "I suppose you could say that this dog is, to some degree, a difficult animal, and I think we should plan accordingly." He turned to me. "James, when he arrives, you get hold of his back end, will you?" "Right," I replied without enthusiasm. He faced his brother. "And you, Tristan, can deal with the head, okay?" "Fine, fine," the young man muttered, his face expressionless. His brother continued. "I suggest you get a good grip with your arms around his neck, and I'll be ready to give him a shot of sedative."
"Splendid, splendid," said Tristan.
"Ah, well, that's capital." My employer rubbed his hands together. "Once I get that dope into him, the rest will be easy. I do like to satisfy my mind about these things."
It was a typical Dale's practice at Derby, mainly large animals, and we didn't have packed waiting rooms at surgery time. But on the following afternoon, we had nobody in at all, and it added to the tension of waiting. The three of us mooched about the office, making aimless conversation, glancing with studied carelessness into the front street, whistling little tunes to ourselves. By 2:25, we had all fallen silent. Over the next 5 minutes, we consulted our watches about every 30 seconds. Then, at exactly 2:30, Siegfried spoke up.
"This is no damn good. I told Joe he had to be here before 5:30, but he's taken not a bit of notice. He's always late, and there doesn't seem to be any other way to get him here on time."
He took a last look out of the window at the empty street.
"Right, we're not waiting any longer. You and I, James, have that colt to cut, and you, Tristan, have to see that beast of Wilson's. So, let's be off."
Up till then, Laurel and Hardy were the only people I'd ever seen getting jammed together in doorways. But there was a moment when the three of us gave a passable imitation of the famous comics as we all fought our way into the passage at the same time. Within seconds, we were in the street, and Tristan was roaring off in a cloud of exhaust smoke. My employer and I proceeded almost as rapidly in the opposite direction. At the end of Trengate, we turned into the marketplace, and I looked round in vain for signs of Mr. Mulligan. It wasn't until we had reached the outskirts of the town that we saw him. He had just left his house, and was pacing along under the moving pall of blue smoke, with Clancy, as always, bringing up the rear.
"There he is!" Siegfried exclaimed. "Would you believe it? At the rate he's going, he'll get to the surgery round about 3:00. Well, we won't be there, and it's his own fault."
He looked at the great curly-coated animal tripping along, a picture of health and energy.
"Well, I suppose we'd have been wasting our time examining that dog in any case. There's nothing really wrong with him."
For a moment he paused, lost in thought, then he turned to me.
"He does look pretty lively, doesn't he?"